welcome along. I am delighted to say that Austin O'Malley is with us here in studio. Austin, it is a pretty amazing weekend of Gaelic games to come, and what else can sports fans ask for than the meeting of Kerry and Dublin and also Derry and Galway in the football?
No, Maria, like, look, it's a super weekend and there's so much in both of these games. It's really like when you think of, I suppose, the history between Dublin and Kerry, and you're looking even from a Kerry perspective, going back to probably that, you know, 2009, since Kerry have beaten Dublin, since that sort of, you know, the start of the Earwigs affair. So, you know, Kerry are very much coming into this, I'd say, maybe perhaps I would say the hungrier team. Looking through it over the course of the week, you know, I've changed my mind a number of times in terms of seeing where the balance will lay. And for me, I think, you know, just in terms of hunger and bench strength, I think Kerry will have it. That allied to the fact, I think, in terms of maybe just the firepower they have up front as well. And obviously there's huge concerns around Conor Callan, whether he'll start or not for Dublin. So it's one that I wouldn't be one bit surprised if it went all the way and went to, you know, into extra time and so on. But I don't think there's going to be too much to separate them. But I just have a slight feeling that Kerry are going to edge it. And I just think in terms of hunger, bench strength, as I said, and again, the Jack O'Connor factor, I think they're going to shade it.
Neil Ewing of Sligo also joins us on the line. Neil, it is a really hard one to call, and there's a lot of factors at play, really, and a lot of variables, and the who's going to start, who's not going to start is definitely top of everybody's list. But you have to wonder, if does it just come down to David Clifford and Conor Callaghan?
It's an interesting one. I think the person in the country I'd most like to be this evening looking at this game is the person who's in charge of printing the programmes for the game on Sunday, because they're probably one of the only people outside the Dublin camp who know if Conor Callaghan is going to be involved in the 26th. Obviously, he's not in the 26th. It's going to be too late now for Dublin to introduce him to the 26th for Sunday with the new rules. So I think the availability of Conor Callaghan, you know, is going to have a huge bearing on this game. David Clifford, I think, you know, obviously he played the last day, he had an injury prior to that, looked like he picked up a new knock the last day, but you know, the soundings are that he should be okay for Sunday. It's a little bit cloudier as regards Conor Callaghan, and you know, whether Dublin are deliberately allowing it to be cloudy or not, I don't know, but I do think Conor Callaghan's ability is going to have a huge stain. And you know, Conor Callaghan, he's a superb player and he'll obviously have a huge impact on the game. I think there's probably even two other factors to it. It's if Conor Callaghan plays, does this take away from the role that Tadhg Morley can play or has to play for Kerry in terms of where he positions himself? And does that allow maybe like Kerry Kenny a little more freedom? But I also think when Conor Callaghan plays, that Cormac Costello and Dean Rock are also a lot more effective, you know, because Conor Callaghan is such a great ball winner, attracts that bit of attention and gives the other two guys inside a lot more room to operate in.
So, Ossie, what if he doesn't play?
Yeah, listen, if he doesn't play, they'll probably go as they did against Cork. It takes away a lot, as Neil alluded to there, to in terms of sort of the symmetry of their forward line and the connection piece. Like, he's an out-and-out ball winner. He brings others into play. And we see, you know, a key characteristic of his game is that he's so unselfish in terms of leaving ball off and bringing others into it. So if he doesn't play, it will hurt Dublin. But they're so experienced in terms of, I suppose, a know-how to win games and the know-how to tactically re-engineer themselves to find another way to win, but he would be a loss. I suspect that we would see him in there. I think in terms of since the Cork game and that he's had time, and would have been an All Ireland semi-final if he's anyways right in this given area. I would think that he would be there. You know,
there's always something so special about the Kerry Dublin rivalry, and one person who knows it particularly well is Ger Brennan. He was out this week speaking to the media. He spoke to our reporter David Wilson just ahead of the Electric Ireland All Ireland Minor Final as well. Here's what he's had to say.
While we have you, we have to ask you about the other massive game that's happened this weekend, Dublin and Kerry in the All Ireland Football Senior Semi Final on Sunday. Mm-hmm. The rivalry between the two teams is legendary. You know, I think the whole country really kind of stops to watch this game. It's you know, maybe the biggest rivalry in the country. What is it like to play in those games?
Growing up playing with St. Vincent's in Dublin, where for decades the majority of any Dublin team was dominated by a lot of the Vincent's players, but the late great Kevin Heffernan, and probably along with Mickey Whelan, I just recall the message being given to us in 2011 that an All-Ireland medal for a dub doesn't feel as good unless you've beaten Kerry along the way. And I would say Jack O'Connor is very much saying the same thing to his guys in his dressing room, that there's nothing like beating a Dublin or a Dublin beating the Kerry on your way to winning an All-Ireland medal. And both management teams will certainly share that with both groups of players. They won't dwell on it for too long. They're more professional and how they prepared in that, but they will use that as a bit of a motivating factor going into that game. But it's a special game to be part of, and I was lucky to have played in the 2011 final and 2013 semi-final, and again, just two wonderful occasions, and the build-ups to those games were just memories that stick with you forever.
Interesting there, Austin Hiranum saying that an All-Ireland title is a little bit sweeter if you beat Dublin or Kerry along the way. I'd say from a Mayo point of view, it doesn't matter as long as you got your hands on it.
Once you got your hands on it, yeah. No, but listen, I suppose, you know, when you look at the history and the heritage and the lineage that goes back to the years between these two, and the great games that have been served up, and, you know, from Free Quinton, obviously, going down to Kerry quite a bit, and you're hearing the stories about the Dubs and you know, going back to those great battles of yesteryear in the 70s and that, and on to now, you know, it does, you know, it really does make it a little bit more special. But, you know, given in the context of what we're looking at coming this weekend, again, as I said earlier, you know, Kerry, I just feel, need this. Like, they have lost their last five encounters to Dublin, you know, and that's going to hurt in terms of Kerry. So it's 13 years since nearly they've beaten them in a championship game since they've met them. So I'm sure Jack O'Connor will use that. And as Ger said there, like, in terms of, you know, you really haven't cut your teeth till you've beaten Dublin in the championship, and that's what Jack will definitely be trying to get into these guys, to get them a little bit more fired up and rank it up. And I think it's a big statement as well for the weekend. It could be in terms of a little bit of changing of the guard, because this is a new Kerry team coming full of young guns, and it's a Dublin team that's perceivably probably on the way in a little bit. So we could see a little bit of a changing of the guard maybe.
Neil, with that in mind though, do you think that it's almost a little bit more significant in terms of what the future could bring as well, depending on who wins here on Sunday?
Yeah, possibly so. I think, you know, we probably haven't even given Desi Farrell enough credit for, you know, the overall and personnel that he's seen since he's came in. You know, the Dublin team now, it looks a lot different. And I know Austin mentioned there, you know, it's a young Kerry team coming, but it's probably a Kerry team that's fairly similar to that which drew with Dublin in the 2019 final as well. So, you know, Kerry, you know, there's been a lot of talk about all the minor All-Irelands they won, you know, five in a row. You know, that team, you know, it really has to come of age now, and they can't have too many more chances. And I think that's probably why they were, well, you could say, a little bit ruthless with Peter Keane last winter, you know, in maybe moving him on, and you know, their choice of the new manager. You know, I know there was a few well, star-studded tickets that were looking to take the Kerry job, but Jack O'Connor has won an All-Ireland in each term that he's been in with Kerry, in the first year of each term, if I'm not wrong. So, you know, Kerry really went for the proven operator when they were picking a new manager, and it's a lot of pressure probably on the players this year. Now the players are just going to be focused on the particular jobs they're going to have to do in the game on Sunday to get over the line, but it's also a lot of pressure on Jack O'Connor. I think, you know, 2009, that game, the start of Leary's game that Austin mentioned, was the last time Kerry beat Dublin in the championship. So, you know, for a county of Kerry's tradition, that's far too long. And I know a lot of the noise outside the camp down in Kerry, if they're beaten again this weekend, you know, it's not going to be a nice place to be for the Kerry players to go back and listen to that for the next few weeks. And the winter itself is going to make for a very long winter. You know, Dublin, a lot of new faces in, there's probably not the same level of expectation on them. And while they've probably been written off this year, and that's probably motivated some of their more experienced players, and I just think for Dublin, Sunday's probably a little bit of a free shot, whereas there's serious pressure on Kerry to get over the line.
Austin, would you go along with that the pressure is on Kerry? Actually, Ger Brennan was asked about that as well by David Wilson. Let's have a listen.
And I suppose it's been a bit of a turnaround for the Dubs this season. You know, they started off the year losing a couple of games, getting relegated from Division 1. But, you know, since then, they've got a couple of players back. They've turned it around. They've put in some good performances. But has the expectation level maybe dropped, and maybe is the pressure slightly off this Dublin side? You know, they don't have the bearing of winning six or seven in a row. It's kind of a new team, and, you know, maybe there's a bit less pressure on them to go win on Sunday.
I would fully agree with your assessment there, David. Everyone could see that during the league campaign, it was a fairly disjointed, oftentimes incoherent, lackluster performances from Dublin. They got a lot of criticism for it. We've seen the response to that criticism in the Leinster campaign. They did the job against Cork without setting the world alight against, again, an average probably Cork team, no disrespect to them. They're obviously in transition themselves. But I'd be slightly worried probably going into the game, David, that we despite the performances in Leinster in particular, but the quality of the challenge hasn't been as strong as in previous years. Will Desi Farrell use that, reduce some of the pressure from the players by saying that all the weight is on Kerry, because all the talk is about this Kerry team, that they're going to break through, they're going to win 3 and 4 and 5 All-Irelands, that, you know, we don't have nothing to prove other than to prove to one another in the group. That's something that he might use, but I just think there's still too much quality and experience in that Dublin team that they will have every expectation to dominate and to win in this game on Sunday.
Chair Brennan there speaking to our reporter David Wilson. Austin, that's quite interesting, because in one sense you can see why there's so much pressure on Kerry, and then on the other side you can see why maybe there isn't as much pressure on Dublin, because that expectation, because of what happened earlier in the year, isn't there, although it has been building steadily since the championship started.
Yeah, no, it is an interesting one to look at, and there's obviously two sides to it. I suppose from the Kerry perspective, that pressure is on in terms of the expectation within the county and the expectation when you get a Kerry jersey that you you go and you do your business and you win All-Ireland. So I think these players are used to that coming up. So I don't think that there's anything, like Jack will obviously use that in the right way, and their setup will use that in the right way, maybe to get an extra percent or two out of guys to really get the juices flowing. And that from the Dublin perspective, I think, you know, given what they've done in the past and given the quality of the calibre of the personnel that they have there, these are guys that will ratchet it up for themselves and bring their own type of pressure in terms of their own individual performances and that. So I don't know if it's going to be, if it's going to be a major noose around either team's neck going into it, because they're all so professional and they'll all be so much focused and concentrated on the moment. But I suppose it's just in terms of pre the game, how you use that and using it in the right way, and both camps will use it equally, I would suspect, to get whatever they need to get out of their guys, you know.
Yeah, well, they'll be well experienced in that for sure. Neil, I was listening to Philly McMahon speaking on the Independent podcast a little bit earlier on, and he was so interesting on David Clifford and what he'd do with him, and I'd actually love to have seen Philly McMahon on him, but obviously he's not there anymore. But he made reference to an interview that he read that had quotes from David in it, which shows just how much he would have studied his prey in ways. And he said that David had said in an interview that he didn't like to get flustered, but he made the point that he didn't really see anybody in the Dublin camp that would maybe be able to fluster him in terms of like the physicality or the verbals that Philly would bring, and he used those words himself. But he did say he could imagine Mick Fitz on him if that's the case. What would you think?
I think in terms of a matchup, Michael Fitzsimons is probably the matchup that looks most appropriate for David Clifford, looking at the current guys that Dublin have available to them at the minute. Just even in terms of that little bit of ranginess, you know, Michael Fitzsimons probably is a little bit taller than maybe he looks when we see him togged out. And David Clifford, I think, does have a strong aerial ability as well. So, yeah, in terms of an out-and-out man marker in that Dublin back line, I think Micah Fitzsimons is probably going to be the go-to guy for them. In terms of, verbals and maybe getting inside David Clifford's head, well, you know, probably two things that I don't think Micah Fitzsimons is that type of character, and that's nothing against guys who are that type of character. I think, you know, there's defenders who go out and, you know, they'll have different approaches. Some guys are you just very tuned into, you know, what their process is, you know, doing everything through the ball, making sure they're in front, covering off their angles. Well, some guys, do like to get involved, and that gives them a bit of an edge, and I suppose they're hoping that'll take away from the opponent as well, or take a bit of edge off him. But yeah, I don't think Mick Fitzsimons is that type of player. But I also think, for Dublin to go out and think that, you know, one man can keep David Clifford quiet is probably a bit naive, and it's not that they're going to put two men on him, but you know, there's going to have to be an element to cover, as Curry will have at the opposite end as well. You know, if nobody's going to leave a full back man exposed or leave a man maybe hung out to dry, you know, Mayo were probably not showing their full hand in the league final this year, and you know, that reflected in the way they set up against Curry. And it left their full back line very, very exposed. And we've seen what David Clifford can do. So, yeah, I think you'll see probably Mick Fitzsimons jump on to David Clifford straight away at the start of the game. But, you know, if he's left one-on-one, there's very little he can do with somebody as talented as David Clifford. You know, the balance that David Clifford has, his ball-winning ability, be that low ball, high ball. You know, he has speed, he has a trick, he has a turn of pace. You know, he has everything that you want in a forward. So, to leave him one-on-one would just be kamikaze stuff from Dublin. And it's not going to happen, or it's not going to happen for the most part. So, you know, that's going to be a huge matchup to watch. One, and, you know, maybe it's a little bit out there, but I think, you know, we're not sure where Davy Byrne's fitness is at. I know he came on the last day, which is encouraging for Dublin, because, you know, when you look through their back six the last day, there's not too many inside markers available to them. So, you know, will Davy Byrne be fit to start? And then the other one is Owen O'Donnell, you know, captain of the Dublin Hurlers, called into the panel after the Hurlers season. I know he plays in the forward line for his club, but, you know, there's rumours that he's been going very well in defence in Dublin training games. And he just looks that type of player. He actually reminds me a little bit of Brendan Rodgers for Derry. You know, he has that physicality. Somebody who, you know, even from playing fullback for the Hurlers, you know, those skills kind of do transfer across, where you're trying to stick very tight to a man, stop a man getting on the ball. You know, is he somebody that the Dubs will look to use for one of their matchups on Sunday? I think that's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, no, I just think it's really fascinating in terms of what Dublin are going to do with Clifford. And I think you're talking about Michael Fitzsimons, and he will be the natural guy to pick him up. But I think the big piece there is the cover and the person that plays in front as that plus one. Now, in the past, we've seen Brian Howard do that quite effectively with his back to the sideline, and he'd take that left side. So I would presume that they'd try and shut down that left side that David Clifford breaks to the spin off his left, and try and drive him out to the right. And the communication between Michael Fitzsimons and his plus one will be really interesting in terms of making sure that cover is there to cut a channel off from Clifford's most potent side, which is that side in terms of arcing. Now, we can obviously come and swing off the other side as well, but I just think in terms of that connection piece there, it'll be a fascinating to see who fills that, and then to look at the communication and the connection between Mick Fitz and the actual plus one there.
Right, I'm going to get predictions at the end, because I do want to move on to Galway and Derry now, Neil. And, you know, we're talking about matchups, and I think when it comes to Galway and Derry, that's where the real fascinating matchups are going to be, because that Galway forward line, we know how potent they are, all scoring from play in the game against Armagh. But if you look at the Derry backs, do they have enough players to contain them, and who do you think is going to pick up Galway's key forwards?
I suppose I've had a soft spot for Derry all year, and, you know, I'll probably carry that into this again. I think they probably do have the guys to match up on the goal forwards, and that's as much in terms of the work Rory Gallagher will have done over the last 2 weeks. You know, 2 weeks ago, if you were to coldly throw them in you know, give them the task of marking a certain goal forward, you know, Derry may have struggled, but they're going to have an awful lot of homework done. And, you know, there's the obvious two in Walsh and Comer up front, and, you know, you're probably looking at you know, maybe Brendan Rodgers and Christy McCaig picking up I suppose one of those, and maybe even alternating in terms of where they position themselves on the pitch. You know, Derry probably won't want Christy McCaig brought too far away from their own goals, whereas Brendan Rodgers is definitely, as we've seen when he took up Michael Murphy in the Ulster final, he's very comfortable out the field. You know, he probably just played as an out-and-out midfielder, or picked up Darren O'Neill from Clare the last day. So Brendan Rodgers probably happier out the pitch than Christy McCaig will be, but probably the two to watch. And I think even Armagh probably put a lot of emphasis on Walsh and Comer the last day, and it allowed you know, Rob Finnerty and Matthew Tierney to step up, and they have been relatively quiet this year to date. So, you know, Derry are probably a little forewarned in terms of that, and you know, maybe Pádraig Joyce may have preferred if Finnerty and Tierney hadn't shown their hand as strongly the last day. But I think that's probably given Rory Gallagher and Enda Muldoon and the Derry backroom team, you know, a lot of video and you know, an early heads up on what those two guys are capable of. So I think they'll have used the 10 days or the last 2 weeks in training very wisely in terms of preparing guys for that. And, you know, there is guys there in the Derry team. Derry have probably been unique in this. They've had like a new, I suppose, a new star man nearly emerge every day. And, you know, I thought Conor McCluskey was particularly impressive the last day. Excellent. And you also have Orban Grogan there. He's probably a little bit under the radar, underrated, you know. So if you're looking, maybe those two guys can step up and keep two more goal forwards quiet this weekend. That could be the difference.
It's interesting as well, looking at Galway and the narrative that's coming into this game, that they tend to fade out. And in a way, just given the fact that Derry like to score their goals early, it's probably, they're not in the worst situation they could be in, but at the same time, they probably need to sort that out.
I know, yeah, without doubt. If you look through the games prior, that they've gone through in terms of Mayo, there was a fade out, two late goals against Roscommon, where they were caught again and again, obviously against Armagh. So there is something there in the DNA in terms of that. There is that little bit of as we've said there, a fade out. So that needs to be rectified. Coming in, like, even to what we looked at there, the previous point in the matchups and that as well, you know, and we said Finnerty and Tierney would play probably a big role. But I just think Derry are ideally set up in terms of their game plan, that Finnerty and Tierney, those little pockets of space that they got against Armagh weren't as diligent as Derry will be in terms of closing out that space and coming back with numbers. So I think in terms of Derry's game plan, it's so well road tested through the melting pot that is the Ulster Championship, and they've found a way to refine it. And as you said there, those early goals, and they have the ability to score goals. If you look up top, I think they're top three between Binnie Hearn, McGuigan and Niall O'Loughlin. They've hit 636, and this has been forgot about in some ways in terms of, we talk about them being a very defensive team, but they can do it the other side of the ball as well. So they've a lot in their holster when it comes to the offensive side and the defensive side. So I would fancy them for this, and I think there's a little bit in this as well. It'll be interesting to see how have Galway recovered after the Armagh game in terms of that big emotional outpouring that was there at the end. And we've seen, you know, Mayo last year bet Dublin in an epic, a kind of a gargantuan game, and couldn't raise their dander for an Ireland final. Then I'm always wary of that from a performance perspective when a team are coming off the back of a really, really emotive performance and there's a huge outpouring. Can you fill your cup up again, and are you ready? So it'll be very interesting the first 5 or 10 minutes this to just see where Galway's pulse is, you know.
And those 5 or 10 minutes, Neil, are going to be so important. One, because Derry like to score early goals, but also because they like to play the game on their own terms. They like to dictate the terms of engagement. And if Galway do that or don't do or let them do that, they could be in serious trouble, as Claire found out very quickly. And just with all of that in mind, then, what do Galway do in terms of a game plan and a setup? Because we've seen so many varying approaches to playing Galway this year. We saw what happened to Clare, and then Donegal up in the Ulster final tried to mirror them, and it did work for long periods of time, but ultimately Derry were able to get the win there. What do Galway do to ensure that Derry don't get away with doing what they're really good at?
Well, maybe Galway probably have the blueprint on how to beat Derry, given they absolutely hammered them in a league game. But I think a lot has changed since that. You know, to be honest, you touched on it there, Marie, in terms of Donegal mirroring Derry. And, like, I honestly think Derry are probably one of, if not the most exciting attacking team to watch in the country when they get that counter-attack opportunity. And I think you really have to not give them that opportunity to counter-attack. How do you do that? You need your back six at a minimum to probably hold their positions, or to have six bodies in those maybe six positions, five or six key positions. And, you know, Galway, Pádraig Joyce, Keane O'Neill have shown they're willing to take a more pragmatic approach this year, you know, dropping in Kieran Molloy, Dylan McHugh. You know, we've probably seen it for the first time in the championship game, or I suppose definitely at its most extreme so far this year, in the championship game against Mayo, where they knew Mayo were a running team, and, you know, they really bottled it up and didn't give Mayo those chances to get in behind them, to get late runners arriving. You know, they had all those spaces filled up, so you're probably going to see something similar to that, I would imagine, the next day. You know, for Galway to go out and maybe, you know, push up on Derry, that's exactly what Derry wants. You know, it opens up the gaps to get those runners from deep. You know, the likes of Conor Glass, Benny Hearn, you know, again, another underrated guy, are going to do, you know, serious damage. We've seen Garrett McInnes burst through and get goals, you know. McCluskey, the last day, came up and kicked the score. So, you know, they have runners coming from everywhere. So you just need to keep a certain amount of bodies back and mind that scoring zone. You don't want to get caught out. And I think as well, Galway, just when it comes to shooting, you know, I've seen some of the days they've had a few shots dropping short. They can't afford to drop shots short the next day against Derry. If you're going to have a shot, it simply has to go dead. And, you know, I think that's something they'll definitely have worked on in training as well. So, you know, while we all want to see, you know, a lovely open game of football, I think Armagh as an opposition probably lended itself to that more so against Galway than Derry will. And you know, that's no slight in any way on Derry. It's just Derry will set up as they need to give themselves the best chance of winning the game. And I think from a Derry perspective, just the thing that Galway probably need to be aware of is, and you know, it's nearly like Rory Gallagher has a little bag of tricks, and he throws something or he just pulls something new out of that every day. So, you know, what's the new thing that Derry are going to bring to this game on Sunday? He'll have noticed Galway's vulnerability under the high ball the last day. So, you know, is that too obvious? I just think Derry could just throw something out of the ordinary that none of us are expecting, and are Galway ready for that or prepared for that? It's very, very hard to be, so that's going to test them also.
Okay, so who's going to contest the All-Ireland football final then, Neil?
For me, it's Derry and Kerry.
Derry and Kerry. Austin?
I'd have to agree. Yeah, that's where I have landed after much deliberation all week.
Derry and Kerry, that's not confusing at all. Neil, we also have the Tailteann Cup final as well. So Westmeath and Cavan there will contest that. It's the early game on Saturday. It's in Croke Park. It's getting a little bit of attention. It's hard when it is coming into a weekend when you have two epic games to come and a lot of other sport as well. Just given the fact that they're, you know, we've seen quite a bit of these two teams now and heard quite a lot from them as well. How do you think this one's going to go?
Yeah, obviously seeing Cavan play against Sligo the last day in the semi-final, and they were at times very impressive, and at other times probably bewildering, you know. In the first half they had 11 different scorers, 10 from play. Rory Gallagher kicked a free also, and you know, for the first 10 or 15 minutes of that game they absolutely shot the lights out, and it, like, they literally couldn't miss. I know they probably had a small bit of a breeze behind them, but you know, very, very impressive. And you, as a Sligo supporter, you thought we could be in a little bit of trouble here. But, you know, Sligo came up the pitch, got themselves settled, got a few scores, and, you know, going into half-time, you know, they're well in the game. But you're thinking coming out in the second half, Cavan, you know, they'll have that little bit of know-how. They're, you know, more experienced team. You know, they'll be able to shut this game down. But it was probably the opposite of that, what they did. You know, Sligo got a few more goal chances on another day. One or two of those multitude of goal chances could have went in, and Cavan could have been beaten. The flip side of that is in the second half they probably showed that extra bit of quality and know-how that they have, and that when Sligo did get it back to a few points, Cavan, it was to an extent they could go up and nearly score on demand. So I don't know if they showed their full hand the last day, but very much a mixed bag. So that gives the likes of Mickey Graham, somebody, you know, a shrewd manager like that, a lot to work on in training for the 3 weeks they've had now between the semi-final and the final. Westmeath, on the other hand, you know, they were just ruthlessly impressive. They went out against an Offaly team that came down from Division 2 and they blew them out of the water. They effectively finished that game in the first half, and you know, you can't read anything into the second half performance because Westmeath had the game won. You know, they've probably had definitely a topsy-turvy league, but they've been pretty impressive as they came through the Tailteann Cup final, and it's just hard to know where Offaly were at. You know, Offaly probably had an easier run of the draw to get to the semi-final the last days, and you know, they really weren't impressive, but Westmeath's runners from deep were hugely impressive. Some of the guys at the back, you know, showed they had you know, man markers that they're going to need to pick up, the likes of Patrick Lynch and Gareth McTiernan for Cavan. You know, I thought Jack Smith, he's a dub playing with Westmeath, and Kevin Maguire, the two of those guys at the back, showed that they probably have the capability of shutting down Cavan's two main men. So, you know, there's going to be a few interesting battles there. And then it's just that it's not so much running power as elusiveness that Westmeath had around the middle. It was, guys coming at a pace, nice little angles, really opened up awfully. So, Mickey Graham is going to have a lot of homework done on that, you'd imagine. So interesting to see how that will play out. And obviously you have John Heslin up front then, who, probably... isn't the same guy to get around the pitch that he was a few years ago, but his accuracy, he's still one of the top forwards in the game. Like, so if they can get the ball to him, he's going to do damage. So again, Calvin with a few good operators at the back there in Killian Brady and Porrick Faulkner, who's going to pick them up. So I think the way the Talton Cup games have been played this year, teams have nearly went out with a bit of abandon, and it doesn't seem that they've had maybe the same defensive structure about them as the top teams. So it'll be interesting to see if both teams carry that into Sunday when there's a trophy on the line, or if there'll be a little bit more pragmatism.
Briefly, Austin, how do you think it's going to go?
Look, just from looking at it, I think they have the big game experience. I think they have the players that, when it counts, over the weekend, that they'll lift in terms of their levels of performance. But maybe just a shout out to Westmeath, I think they've been brilliant, and in particular, I would love to see them win that. I think it would be great for football in the county, and also for Jack Cooney, who I read somewhere during the week has been involved with Westmeath football for nearly 22 years at senior level, between playing and coaching and so on. So a guy that has given unbelievable service. So it would be brilliant to see the likes of him get his just rewards. But unfortunately, I think maybe Calvin just did it.
Right. Okay, Neil and Austin, thank you so much for joining us. Definitely a super weekend of football to look forward to. We're going to take a very quick break, but stay with us because we'll be talking tennis. Game on 2FM. Now, welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to tennis, and Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View has just walked into this studio to inform me that Novak Djokovic has won and has advanced to the final.
Indeed, a shocker here that Novak Djokovic is into his eighth Wimbledon final, and he has a chance to win his seventh title, which would match Pete Sampras's record, still one shy of Roger Federer. As I was just saying off air, Novak is like a Venus flytrap, where Stefano Tsitsipas, Lorenzo Musetti, Yannick Sinner, Cam Nori all get lured into this thing of maybe he's not quite as good as he used to be, maybe we can win a set or two and change momentum. Nope, it's still Novak.
So you were over there last week, so you've seen him obviously up close and personal, and there was a little bit of a theory flying around that he's doing it on purpose, that he is like saving the real Novak, the Novak form to later in the matches. Would you buy into that?
It's very hard to tell because he's had such a unusual year. Everything is riding on Wimbledon. So we had the Australian Open debacle, the French Open. He had a surprisingly subpar performance against Rafael Nadal. He may not be allowed to enter the US Open because of vaccination rules. So it's kind of all or nothing, it seems, at the moment for Wimbledon. But again, he is human. Not that we see much of it on the tennis court. So is it really just he needs something to get himself going by dropping a set or two? Or maybe there is a chance that, a bit like Nadal and Federer, they are waning a little bit. Mm-hmm. They still find a way in the end, but they're not quite run through in three sets.
Yeah, well, Nadal did say he wouldn't be able to do those two games. So, I mean, that just shows that they've only got a certain amount in them, that's for sure. So it is going to be a final between Djokovic and Kyrgios. What should we expect? I just don't know.
Kyrgios is a fairly dull character. I'm not sure if we can really find any excitement about his fortnight. Well, the one thing that's really interesting is Nick Kyrgios is one of the only people who has a positive head-to-head record against Novak Djokovic. Okay. The head-to-head is 2-0.
Good starting place.
No one likes playing Nick Kyrgios, obviously, particularly on a fast course like Wimbledon. I think we'll expect fireworks, whichever way happens. If Djokovic is playing incredibly and rolling through Kyrgios, I'm sure there'll be all sorts of shenanigans on the other end of the court. Or we could have an epic of five sets. If Kyrgios can really find that serve, keep up a high first serve percentage, get his early shot in, then we could have a great match. It really depends. A lot of it depends actually on Kyrgios, probably, because you know what Djokovic is going to do.
Mm-hmm. I just hope that after it all we're talking about the tennis and not the sideshow.
Yeah, there's no place to hide now for Nick. There's often been a theory that he uses excuses because he doesn't want to face the concept that he could play these guys and not be good enough. He'll always kind of find, oh, I was injured or this, whatever happened. Here's your chance. This is the golden chance of his career. He's finally in a Grand Slam final. He's playing one of the best players of all time. It's his best tournament in terms of a Grand Slam opportunity. What has he got? Show us all the talent that we know you have, but can you do it over the five sets against one of the greatest players of all time?
I loved reading the interview with his mom earlier, where she said that the reason that he's had such an, I suppose, a refocusing at times anyway this year was because he's given up video games. So she said he was playing all the time, like wouldn't leave the room, didn't want to go anywhere. All he wanted to do was play video games, and now he's given it up.
So that's the key then. So if I give up video games, does that mean that I'll make them in the final?
Well, she said even he had a sore shoulder. He didn't want to go like see any tourist attractions. All he wanted to do was play video games.
I think it's an important note to say that, okay, he's made a final, so that's a change. If he hadn't made a Grand Slam final, while we're all caught up in the real-time aspect of Nick Kyrgios, once he retires, if you haven't made a Grand Slam final or won one, no one talks about you. Like, you wouldn't actually go down anywhere in history of, say, an important player if you don't make a final or win a title. So it'd be really interesting to see what he can show us on Sunday.
Okay, so predicted. Since I'm asking the lads for football predictions, I'll be asking you for tennis predictions as well.
I think it's very hard to go past Djokovic. He's the best grass court player at the moment. It means so much to him. But it wouldn't surprise me if it went 4 or 5. It really depends on if Kyrgios can kind of keep some of the shenanigans at bay and really focus on his first serve percentage and getting the ball in court.
So buckle up, basically. We could be in for a bumpy
It'll enough. Be brilliant, yeah. It'll be absolutely brilliant.
So the women's final is on as well. So Yvonne Jabeur against Elena Rybakina.
Yeah, it's a great story on either side. I was surprised to actually learn it's the first time on the women's side at Wimbledon's in the open air you have two first-time finalists. So it's kind of, there's first everywhere. It's the first Kazakh player, of male or female, to make a Grand Slam final. I don't know what to say. It's the All England club that actually, Rybakina was born in Moscow, is a Russian, transferred to Kazakhstan in 2018. So I don't know how that'll go down. But she's a great story in herself. She was kind of derailed by the pandemic. She had amazing form going into the start of 2020, was in 4 finals, and then couldn't really adjust like the rest of us to the change in the world and the situation. Ange Jabeur is the first Tunisian, the first Arab woman, the first North African to do almost everything on the tour. She's the second best player on the tour this year after Iga Swiatek. This will be her 5th final. She's really put together. She's an absolute genius on the course. Every shot you can think of, particularly drop shot, she's kind of managed away over the last couple of years to harness that in a productive sense. And she's an awesome force to watch. It should be a really good final, actually. A real contrast of your kind of Sharapova, Kvitova-ish type person. And then just a genius on the other end. And so I'm really looking forward to it. So that'll be tomorrow at 2.
Okay, and give us a prediction for that one as well.
I actually think Rybakina, if she plays like she did against Simona Halep, will win. I thought she was absolutely incredible. I think she might just have too much power. She's the ace leader on the tour. She's hitting the ball so cleanly. It wouldn't surprise me if it was a repeat of, say, a Sharapova, Kvitova Wimbledon performance where she might just blow Ange Jabeur off the court.
It's mad. It's like we're in the middle of, well, we're in early July and there's so much sport going on. Like the All Blacks are playing Ireland as well first thing in the morning. So talk about having a weekend. Like if you were self-isolating now, you'd be like, okay, maybe it's not so bad because they've got a lot that we can watch. So that Ireland New Zealand game is on as well. And Ireland completed their preparations for that second test against New Zealand with their captain's run in Dunedin earlier today. Head coach Andy Farrell reported no late injury concerns. The game is a sellout and will be played in front of a full house for the first time since 2018. It is raining heavily in Dunedin though, but the game has been played in an indoor stadium. The All Blacks do love an indoor stadium. So they have never lost a test game there in the 7 previous games for them at the venue. Ireland wing Mac Hansen returns to the starting team having overcome COVID, a subject he spoke to Michael Corcoran about after the captain's run.
Yeah, really good. I not going to lie, I struggled it at first. My first couple runs, I was struggling out there big time, but came around pretty quick, so I feel 100% and back to normal.
Is it a help or a hindrance, or otherwise the fact it's a dry track outside because it's chucking down rain outside?
No, I think it's definitely a help for both teams, just for good running rugby. Like we both play pretty similar styles, I'd say, like to keep the ball in field, so yeah, whenever you can play on a dry pitch, it's just better for everyone. It's a better spectacle.
In terms of tomorrow, I would imagine that the focus is really much in Ireland trying to cut down that error rate from last week.
Yeah. End of the day, it's just what you can control. Like you, as you said, all the errors, they feed off that. So we can bring those down. It's going to make for a lot closer game. And I thought last week isn't how we normally play and how we've been playing. So as I said, yeah, plenty of work ons, but plenty of learnings.
Have you spoken about trying to convert more chances, try scoring opportunities into actual tries?
I guess that is the plan, isn't it? It's the aim of the game. So, look, our attack I thought was pretty good last week. You know, nobody really Like you hear rarely about getting held up six times. It's obviously just that last bit that we have to work on, but I think we show that the attack is there. It's just getting that ball over the, just getting it down over the line.
Tomorrow is potentially a series decider. It's 1-0, but there's two games left, so you got to make the most of tomorrow.
Yeah, we're not here to just take part, I guess. We're, we want to get a win over here, be the first team to do it. So, you know, that's always a nice thing to have on our shoulder. We've got nothing to lose, really, and, you know, New Zealand rarely lose over here, so, you know, more pressure on them.
And just a final question in terms of the, I want to say the mood in the camp, but the way that everybody is kind of gelled together this week, you've come down from Auckland, and you feel there's a big chance within this party tomorrow?
Yeah. I think everybody's kind of definitely written us out straight away. We had a very good Six Nations and Autumn Test leading up to that. So, you know, people can say what they want to say. We know what we need to do to get a win, and there's great feeling around the group at the moment. So if everybody wants to write us off, that's great.
Game on 2FM. Welcome back to Game On. It is almost 10 to 7. Austin O'Malley is with me in studio. Austin, a texter, has reminded us as well that it's a busy weekend for Gaelic games, and Galway and Mayo are contesting the All-Ireland Minor Football Championship final this evening in Hyde Park.
That's right, yeah. No, listen, I'm looking forward to actually getting home and watching that. It's an interesting one because actually Mayo have beaten Galway twice already this year between in Connacht and their own Robin. So I'm sure Galway will be looking to right a few wrongs from that. But, a very strong Mayo minor team in terms of beating Kildare and had a pretty stiff challenge against Kerry on the last day out, and Galway have found a bit of form as well in terms of taking Dublin and Derry out, so I said it'd be a cracker later on this evening.
Yeah, those minor games are always brilliant football, well worth tuning in for. Now, it is also a busy time for the Women's Euros. Spain are in action against Finland. It is almost full time. They are leading 3-1. They lost Alexia Putella earlier to a knee injury, and she's their best player, but they don't seem to be missing her too bad today, albeit it is the first game of the tournament for them, and Germany and Denmark is on at 8 o'clock. Well, Fergal Brennan joins us now on the line to talk all things football. And Fergal, the big story today is that Cristiano Ronaldo is not included in Manchester United's pre-season squad for those games in Thailand and Australia. What could that possibly mean?
I think the important thing to look at in terms of the official line that United are saying is that it's a family issue. He's been given permission to stay in Portugal with his family. Obviously, there's been a lot of attention on that because, you know, we're looking back to earlier on this year, the incredibly sad news that him and his partner lost a child. So I think that is important to place into the context of this, that United have played a fairly straight bat in terms of the reason that he won't be travelling. And obviously, that is Ronaldo's own personal business. However, looking further ahead into the next couple of weeks and towards the start of the season, it is very clear that he's open to leaving Manchester United. He's determined to play Champions League football next season. Obviously, that's not going to be happening at Old Trafford. And that position hasn't really changed. He won't be involved in these pre-season games. That's a separate issue. Aside from a potential transfer away from the club, Chelsea and Bayern Munich, from what I've been hearing from people I've been speaking to connected with the club, are the front runners looking at a possible move. Chelsea are obviously looking to shake things up after their buyout this summer. Romelu Lukaku has gone back to Inter Milan, so there is a space at Stamford Bridge. And then at Bayern Munich, if Robert Lewandowski does go to Barcelona, they're still working on that potential deal, then there would be an option to go there as well, despite the fact that they've obviously just brought in Sadio Mane. So I think this effectively comes down to Ronaldo and his willingness to take a pay cut. He's the highest paid player in the Premier League, somewhere in the region of $440,000-$450,000 a week. Wherever he goes, he is going to have to take a little bit less than that. But he does appear absolutely determined to play in the Champions League next season. And if he accepts and if a club is willing to say, yes, we think you can add something to us, then it could be a goer. But as it stands, there's not really a massive amount of movement. And Erik ten Hag will try and keep him if he can kind of assuage those doubts that Ronaldo has at the moment.
Okay, well, it feels like one that's going to run and run anyway, for sure. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. Jack Wilshere announced his retirement today. I was surprised that he was only 30. I think a lot of people were, really, just given the amount of potential that he had as a young player. And I think we know in football it's quite difficult to fulfil your potential. How do you think people will reflect on his career?
I think there'll be a lot of sympathy for him in terms of the frustration behind the reasons why he is stepping away from football, and it is injuries. He's just had the worst run of luck with injury after injury, and we're talking about stretching back the best part of a decade, probably since he broke through as a teenager at Arsenal. From his early 20s up until now, he's constantly suffered with getting himself back fit and then another injury setback. And yeah, there'll be a little bit of sadness, particularly from Arsenal fans, that this idea of potential maybe not fulfilled, or sorry, definitely not fulfilled from what was expected from him. But it is just so frustrating because there's nothing more that either Arsenal or he himself could have done to prevent these things. And despite the developments in sports science and injury mm-hmm. prevention and that type of thing, sometimes your body can just let you down. I think there might be conversations about how his breakthrough was handled by Arsenal, by England, was too much placed on him too young. That's a conversation probably for a little bit further down the line, but very disappointing for Jack Wilshere because he was such an incredible prospect, and yep. injuries just eventually have proven too much for him.
Yep, it happens. Fergal Brennan, thank you so much for those updates. We will be talking to you again soon, but now we're going to join Jane Mangan, who's going to bring us up to date with everything that's happening in the racing world. And Jane, it's my kind of week when we're talking about stories that have a little bit of drama attached to them, like the Godsend Tory drama, which unfortunately seems to be all settle now in a very amicable way.
It does. God, we gotta love a bit of drama, Marie. I've been listening to your show there, from the rugby to the tennis. We've all been tuning into Wimbledon for the last 2 weeks. We're all professionals at it, having, you know, never watched tennis only once a year. But yeah, there's so much sport happening, and on the racing front, there is loads of action on and off the track. You mentioned John and Thady Gosden, and they had a little bit of a inadverted commas sabbatical from Frankie mm-hmm. Dettori. I listened today, they had John Gosden and Frankie Dettori have teamed up for 60 individual Group 1 wins. Isn't that incredible, the success that they've had? But I suppose there's been a rumble of thunder every now and again, and I think it all came to a head at Royal Ascot a couple of weeks ago, where they had a couple of notable misses hitting the crossbar a couple of times, with the likes of Stradivarius, Saga, Reach for the Moon, and there was a number of frustrations. And they vented that, or the Gosdens in particular vented that in public, and it looked like there might be a break in the marriage, but it hasn't lasted very long, because he was aboard Mighty Ulysses yesterday when they won at Newmarket, and he was aboard in Spiral today. That was the big question mark, whether he would ride her. He did ride her. She went off at odds of 1-9 in the Falmouth Stakes today, and she got beaten.
Oh.
No fault of trainer or jockey. She just got beaten. She was a facile winner of the Coronation Stakes at Ascot. She didn't back up today, but it's good to see the team Gosden Dettori back, because it's a little bit like Ferguson and Ronaldo. They're just so, they've all conquered all of the peaks in racing, and it would be a shame if they, I suppose, separated on terms that were not amicable. But it seems like the marriage is back together, and it was just a break. They were like Ross and Rachel. They were on a break.
I was loving it. I was like, it was like Love Island in the racing world. There was so much going on, and it was like waiting for the next installment. What's he going to say next? He said, she said. Anyway, sure, look, I'm sure it'll fall apart again at some stage. That's the way these things
It's just unusual, isn't it, to see it unravel in public. Yeah. Usually these things happen and you never really know why, and I actually found the honesty of both parties a little bit refreshing. You know, we often end up guessing and coming to completely inaccurate summations, but they were very open. You could say laundry, but I would consider it just open with their opinions, and they seem to have sorted it out.
All right, okay. Well, sure, keep me posted anyway. Between yourself and Ruby, I feel like I'm usually in tune with all the racing gossip. I didn't need it, though, from you guys, because it was all out there for me to find myself. So what about on the track over the weekend, Jane? What is happening?
Yeah, it's all happening on an international scale this weekend, as is typical of the flat season. Ruby is on track for Racing TV at Newmarket, where he saw Inspiral get beaten by Prosperous Voyage today in the Falmouth, and he'll be on track for the July Cup tomorrow. 14 runners in the sprint, 3 of them are Irish. Romantic Proposal for Chris Hayes and Eddie Lynham. Twilight Jet bids to bounce back from a disappointing Royal Ascot for Michael O'Callaghan and Lee Roach. I think he had an excuse at Ascot. I think there was a dirty scope post race race. So hopefully Twilight Jet can prove better than we saw at Ascot. And Cadamusto for Aidan O'Brien and Ryan Moore, they're the trio in the July Cup, but they're going to have to be good because this year's July Cup seems to have a lot of depth. You've got Perfect Power, the Commonwealth winner in there for Richard Fahey and Christoph Soumyon. King Hermes for Japan, a very good sprinter in Japan. Can he translate that form to the UK? Artorias is over from Australia. We know he came over for Royal Ascot. He was third in the Platinum Jubilee behind Naval Crown, who also reopposes. But Artorias had a lot of traffic in running. Jamie Spencer held up, came from nearly last. So if Artorias could raise the roof for Australia, I'm sure for international racing that would be a huge result. And William Buick is staying loyal to Creative Force. So that's in Newmarket. But on an international scale, there is the Belmont Oaks and the Belmont Derby. 13 runners in the Derby, Stone Age amongst them. We haven't seen him since he disappointed at Epsom. He was the first string for Aidan O'Brien that day in the Derby. He teams up again with Ryan Moore. And Nation's Pride, he was also a disappointment at Epsom for Charlie Appleby. He runs in the Belmont Derby. And interestingly, Frankie Dettori flies to the US to ride him, as he does team up with Appleby with the Moonlight in the Belmont Oaks. Aidan O'Brien is concert hall in there. And Joseph O'Brien has Agartha. Johnny Velasquez riding her. And this is the interesting point. It emerged this week that Joseph O'Brien, obviously based in Piltown, has set up a satellite yard in Saratoga, New York.
Oh, wow.
And I think this is a real visionary move because Joseph, like a lot of trainers in Ireland and the UK, he has a lot of US-based owners, and he's going to want to be running these horses in the US. And rather than flying them back and forward across the Atlantic, or are they making the permanent move to the US and leaving his yard? He's going to take a small number of boxes in Saratoga and race horses from there. A satellite yard in the US. Joseph O'Brien.
Right, well,
he's a real international trainer.
When you're going over to visit, you have to bring me with you because I do love a trip for New York. We're going to have to go now, though, because we're out of time, but we will check in with you next week for sure. I'll be back Monday looking back on a very busy weekend of sport. Austin O'Malley, thank you so much for coming in. Our very own Dermot O'Brien is up next with the official chart show.